Hello and welcome to the Wealth Chat, brought to you by SG Kleinwort Hambros. I'm Jonathan Speck, Senior Partner at Mourant in Jersey.
I'm Jonathan Needham, Head of Trust and Succession Planning for Societe Generale Private Banking.
And I'm Simon Kleiss, Head of Private Client Trust for SG Kleinwort Hambros.
In today's episode, we're asking why having a succession plan is important. If you fail to plan, you will plan to fail.
With COVID, I spent 2 years sitting, sadly, mostly in my house doing wills. A lot of people around the world for the first time really got really worried about dying or being incapacitated. And that was a prompt for people to consider their succession planning.
When I see successful families manage their wealth well, it's because they have a clear vision, maybe combined ambition about the way they steward the money and how it's to be used. And that will help see the wealth pass through generations.
One shouldn't just look at dealing with these issues as the proprietary right of the very wealthy. It affects everybody. So I think it's a more broader discussion than most people think.
To help us explore this, we are joined by Siobhan Riley, a partner at Carey Olson in Jersey, and by Beatrice Puotti, a partner at Stevenson Harwood in London. Siobhan specialises in trusts and private wealth management, and she is an expert on private and commercial trust structuring. Bea deals with international trust, estate and tax planning for individuals and families and their fiduciaries. Bea, I think you are the best and most famous wealth planner in London. You're a top lawyer. I'm going to pretend for a minute that I've got lots of money. I'm going to say to you, why should I have a plan for it?
Well, Jonathan, I'm very grateful for your comment. You should have, at the very least, a will or an LPA.
What's an LPA?
An LPA is a limited power of attorney, which deals with the situation where a person is incapacitated and somebody else can decide. Make a decision over their property or also their health.
So you plan for incapacity in advance.
Exactly, and you provide a power to someone to look after your health or your property in case you can't. A little statistic given to me by somebody else, so I can't vouch for it, but it's a study by Canada Life, and he said that 50% of British adults don't have a will. Two-fifths had no concerns of any type. One-sixth has no intention of having a will. One-third of the over 55, which is definitely not you, Jonathan, has not made a will and have no intention of making one. 25% did not think that they had sufficient funds to make a will. And one-fifth thinks that in any event, their loved one will get the assets. Now, the problem with this is that most people don't know what happens if you don't have a will and something happens to you. And it also does not take into account where they come from, their origin. For example, if you have a mixed family, an international family with a common law, governing law partner from Britain and a partner from Europe, like me, you know, I'm Italian, then the blend between common law and forced heirship causes problems. Also, with COVID, I spent 2 years sitting, sadly, mostly in my house doing wills. A lot of people around the world for the first time really got really worried about dying or being incapacitated. And that was a prompt for people to consider their succession planning. And also talking about your estate and your position in your family is the first step to avoid problems later on, but we'll discuss that.
Okay. Let me just ask John a quick question here. I know, John, you've got masses of experience of surveys into wealth management. What's your experience of what really wealthy families are worried about?
Yeah, well, I think first and foremost, I think it changed in around 2008-09 when we had the last significant financial crisis, because I think wealthy families at that point were actually identified as being part of the problem rather than the solution. So I think there was a more than a paradigmal shift at that particular point in time. If you pick up most wealth management surveys today and the standard question arises from the consultants, which is, you know, what are the 10 or 5 main things that concern wealthy families today? And invariably, in every single survey, within the top 3 at the max top five is this issue around succession planning. How do they plan for their succession? How do they plan for the wealth transition to the next generation or future generations, however many there may be? And that ranks highly. So I think if you take a broad brush approach to that, roughly two thirds, 65 to 70%, identify that as an issue. And actually more than 50% haven't done anything about it. That's a concern.
Okay, so if I listen to this wise advice from John and from Bea, I can see I need a plan. So what do? I write the plan down and then I lock it in my drawer? Is that the right approach, Bea?
No, I mean, the will is a great way of sitting down with somebody. And the first thing I do is to sit and understand the dynamic of the family. I always say to people, you know, the will is a first step. And especially if people are reluctant, some cultures, they don't like doing a will because they think it's going to make them die sooner. I'm not joking. So it is a funny, but once you sit down and you go through the assets and also the dynamic of the family, especially nowadays, 50% of families throughout the world are blended. They have children from previous marriages, and there are also issues with gender, a new issue with gender we need to be dealt with the documentation. So it is really important that the sitting down and looking at the plan and doing the will, the power of attorney, again, because otherwise, especially if you're dealing with a decision maker, everything is blocked if they don't have one. That is something that needs to be done and needs to be done. I always say to people they should review their affairs every 5 years, because one thing is if you are a young man just coming out of a liquidity event with a young family, your concerns will be one. And the other spectrum is the older person that wants to sort of leave a legacy and have children, and he knows what these children are doing and is different and everything in the middle. So it isn't something that should be in the drawer. It should be something that should be reviewed periodically, and also every time there is an event in life that will mean that you have to change. And nowadays we are global families and people move. So every time you should review what you're doing, because the consequences of a family member, of a wealthy family being somewhere else, the amount of time that I've been told, oh, but I've got a couple of children in the US. And I say, oh, yes, that's nice.
And is that a problem?
To review everything. No, it's a lovely country, but it does have its challenges from a planning point of view. So there are things that need to be looked at.
Well, you two have convinced me that I need to have a plan, but I'm not sure about London. I need to go to the top wealth planning lawyer in the Channel Islands. Siobhan, tell me, my plan is that my family wealth is going to be preserved, but I'm worried that my grandchildren will end up in rags, just as I start off in rags. What can I do?
And I think you'd be right to be concerned. I think the received wisdom about generational wealth is that it will struggle to survive three generations. And I was intrigued by this in terms of how it is that people who are very wealthy in their lifetime leave a lot of money, that it doesn't survive beyond, or there's a struggle for it to survive beyond three generations. And it seems as though it's a globally recognised challenge of having wealth that can survive that long. I noticed that in Italy, Bear, I understand we talk about stables to stars to stables in three generations.
Yes.
In Japan, they say the third generation ruins the house. In the north of England, which I think is the first time you see reference to it in the 19th century, is from clogs to clogs. So it seems to be a globally recognised concept. I was intrigued also just to understand where it comes from, because the other dynamic to this, and actually the origin of it, appears to be Chinese. And a colleague in our Singapore office translated the philosopher Monzi, where this comes from. And the opening line of this phrase around challenges of three generations, his opening remark is that morality can pass more than 10 generations, but for a rich and noble family doesn't last longer than three generations. So something about behaviours and values, that's all part of, I think, how part of the plan, I feel, and when I see successful families manage their wealth well, it's because they have a clear vision, maybe combined ambition about the way they steward the money and how it's to be used. And that will help see the wealth pass through generations. And I think probably the best blend is usually a combination of family, together with some professional support. I think as generations go past, you end up with more members of each generation, and it gets more difficult, really, to arrange affairs, to direct what's happening, to take decisions. So having a blend of both the family contributing and influencing, but also for some professional support, in my experience, is generally the best way to try and manage these things, and certainly to guard against the three-generation scourge.
So having a plan is absolutely key to this wealth preservation. Do you have fixed ideas about what the plan should actually be, Siobhan?
I think it depends on the family of what their priorities are. And I think some families find it very difficult to even begin to make a plan. And I say to clients I speak to, just think of the single most important objective to begin with. And then you can at least move forward and start the process, because I think you otherwise become bogged down in multiple options. Almost too difficult. It takes time, and these things are iterative in the way that Bear talks about revisiting things every 5 years. They do take time to develop. So I think you do need a plan. I think it's challenging with a plan. So without a plan, I think it can be really very difficult, very uncertain for families, and certainly uncertain about the outcome if you don't have a plan and die suddenly or incapacitated suddenly.
Simon, you've been a wealth manager. You've been a trustee in your case for many decades, but you were telling me about one structure you've got which has lasted for 100 years. What on earth was the secret of the success of that? I mean, you weren't there for the whole 100 years.
Not quite, no. Yeah, it's an interesting case. And, you know, so far we've spoken, about, you know, wills and, you know, sort of estates sort of side of things. As you just mentioned, I'm more on the trust side, which is another solution that we've not sort of spoken about, where, you know, wealth can last in perpetuity now and under trust law. Sorry, just going back to the sort of estates bit, and why I'm going to mention about trust is because there can be some downsides to that sort of solution that we've mentioned, which is particularly for some sophisticated and wealthy families. They have assets in different parts of the world, meaning that fine, you might have a will covering your worldwide assets, but to get probate in each of the jurisdictions, it can take time, and that can also be complex. So the reason why I mentioned sort of trust, and then moving back to the sort of question about, you know, the generation to generation thing, is that it is a good solution. It's been tried and tested. It's, you know, been around for a long time. And certainly, as you mentioned, I am involved with cases, you know, where we're dealing with third, fourth, fifth generations. In, as you say, I've not been around sort of for that amount of time, but, you know, I like to draw out the point of having a trust, you know, a trusted advisor. It doesn't have to necessarily be a, you know, a trustee, but I'll use that in this sort of context, that, you know, has that continuity, you know, with the family as you shift from generation to generation. And I think it stands in really good stead where things actually do go wrong, you know, with families, and you sort of start to have perhaps some conflict there, because having that strong, trusted advisor who perhaps knew well the wealth curator as you sort of skip through the generations, you know, they provide the best witnesses where things go wrong to say, I was present at this time. I'm not reading some file note perhaps from decades ago. So continuity, yes, certainly with individuals, but continuity of trusted advisor. And then I think the succession of that trusted advisor as well is really sort of key to keep that harmony within families, because understanding the dynamics of that family is key, and it does change from generation to generation. I see that with my own family, who are very much more sort of socially responsible, but perhaps more than I am now. They have sort of different ideas about how you invest and what happens, you know, to that wealth. So again, I think you have to be fairly modern and understand that the changes as you do go through generation to generation and the different ideas, and not perhaps to be totally stuck with what the wealth creator always sort of wanted. So I think, again, going back to that continuity, that sort of consolidation with a trusted advisor will help guide that family through those various generations that we were talking about.
Well, continuity is clearly your watchword, Simon, and I love the phrase trusted advisor. And when I think of trusted advisor, I'm instantly looking at John Needham, who spent decades being a trusted advisor.
Careful.
More than two decades. What's the secret of maintaining these structures together for so long? We hear about continuity, trusted advisor. How do you do it, John?
I think it's about One, you need to be a really good listener. I mean that in the broadest of contexts. It's actually giving your clients time to express themselves and to, echoing some of the sentiments that Siobhan had, actually allowing them to navigate some of this for themselves. It shouldn't be a prescriptive process. And I think our role is to guide them, help guide them in those deliberations by raising sensible challenges along the way, getting them to think about the what-if scenarios and helping them formulate their own ideas and actually then get them down in some sensible order on paper, for want of a better medium. That is very much part of our role. I think the other element and one element I've always been very keen on is always be very honest with your client. If you see something or they have a view that you know is wrong or isn't going to work, then you need to tell them. You shouldn't shy away from the fact just for the sake of pleasing a client. You do need to demonstrate integrity and honesty in those discussions. Because if you don't do that, and it does all go wrong, it will be a reflection of you, it will be a reflection of the work that you've done, and it will be the reflection of the institution for whom you work. And that's not a good place to be, because you want to be a trusted advisor, and that trusted advisor role is both at an individual level and corporately, or in the sense of a partnership in a legal context. So I think it's a very rounded discussion, but I always start with my clients, even in the very early stages, of striking a bargain. And my bargain is, do you accept the principle that I have the right to disagree with you and say no to you?
And learning how to say no well must be at the heart of why you're so successful, John.
Well, it is an art, but I think if you can't agree that as a principle very early in your relationship, particularly talking about emotive subjects such as this, you're really setting everyone up for a fall.
You have said the word that I was going to try and get out of you, and you've said it. Relationship. Yeah. Doesn't it all boil down to good relationship management?
Yeah, it is about relationship, and it's not just simply the social aspects of that relationship. I think it's far deeper and far more meaningful, and I know because I've worked with Siobhan for a long time, I've worked with Bea before, Simon I've worked with closely for many years, and yourself. And you know that these people, all of the people around this table, and many others, have this sense of integrity and honesty, and also a passion for what they do. And translating that into a meaningful relationship with a client builds trust with that client, builds trust with not only them, but also their future generations, which is the bedrock of most of what we do.
Thank you, John. I'm going to turn straight back to Bea, talking about trusted relationships. You sit in London. You advise the international wealthy as a London-based lawyer. You have a great overview of what happens. So let's think. We're putting this plan together. How do you choose where to send your clients? And when I say where to send them, where do they go to get the kind of relationship, the kind of fiduciary, the kind of manager that John has just described?
I would like to say one thing to echo John. Yesterday, I had a client, a new client, who came to me from another very reputable, good firm. And you know what he said, exactly what he said. He said, I want an advisor that doesn't say, you could do this, you could do that. It tells me, I think you should do that. And he says, I haven't got one. So what you were saying, somebody expresses their opinion. But anyway, when you have the plan, and the plan mostly for our clients are international plans. And the international plans mean that you have to look at different jurisdictions, depending on what the plan is. We are talking here about clients with different classes of assets, and so the plan is not a straightforward one, and normally it involves other structuring. Where do they go where are the people that they need to trust to go? And partly is values, is what John was saying, and also Simon was saying, you know, people who have identical value, but also jurisdiction. And I think the jurisdiction is, I am asked often if I want to place a structure somewhere, what is it? And I always say, you know, you should look at the strength of the law, the strength of the courts, the strength of the advocate in the courts. And that is, Speck is one of the amazing example of the brilliant lawyers that you have in Jersey. But this is what you look at, because in the end of the day, when you put a plan in place, I always think that I think of what the objectives are for the family, but also you immediately look at the threats to those objectives. So you always need to think of the worst to plan for the best. I know you English law, but I'm also privileged to know the best in the various jurisdictions, and I know how the jurisdiction operate. And I think that is the legal system and the courts, and also the strength of the fiduciary and the regulatory environment nowadays is really important, and the reputation of all of us, and working with people who are honestly like-minded and will sort of provide services and trusted advice to the clients.
You sound like a matchmaker, Bear.
I am often, because you have a huge responsibility. Clients come to you and say, where should I go to do this? And I am very mindful of matching the client and what they are and how they are to the right people. Because in the end of the day, if the relationship goes pear-shaped and you put it in place, it reflects back on everyone and is not the best interest of the client.
The great thing about advisory lawyers like you, Bear, like you, Siobhan, is that you understand the threats.
Yes.
That modern families, international families, are likely to face. Do you have some key ones that you can share with us? Threats from, I don't know, creditors?
I mean, I think the one in the UK, a very big issue for wealthy families is divorce, because of the system of the UK courts on divorce is very, very different from, for example, European countries, where there are matrimonial regimes, which is very specifically sort of established. What happens on divorce in the UK, everything is decided by the courts. So again, going to the planning, prenup and postnups, and also in relation to trust structuring, the amount of time that people forget asking the question of the matrimonial regime before settling a trust, because there is actually the ownership of the assets is at stake. So divorce, also creditors, and if there is a business protection of the business, attack on the business and the assets of the business, literally these are the two main worries that clients have, and political. Nowadays sounds odd, but the geopolitical environment, economical solidity of where you put your assets, banks, you know, all the geopolitical, you need to know all of these things and navigate with the client their concerns.
I'm going to pick up on one point and hand it straight to Siobhan, if I may. My ears pricked up when you talked about prenups and postnups and divorce. Is that something, Siobhan, that as a trust lawyer, as a wealth planning lawyer, you see you need to legislate for, you have to handle?
We do. Divorce is probably one of the principal reasons families lose wealth. So it is a serious consideration. I think probably one in two marriages in the Western world certainly end in divorce. So it's pretty sad but a realistic statistic. So it is. And I think that having structures which allow for a family to benefit and indeed prevent benefit unless there is a prenuptial agreement in place, as stand, we see that very frequently now. Difficult conversations, but again, these things are part of the relationship, I think, and the conversation that needs to be had about protecting the wealth in the longer term. So certainly we're very used to seeing that. There was a vintage of trusts where spouses were part of the beneficial class, if you had a trust, for example, but that's less so now, because the intention is really that it should be for the bloodline. But again, there are all manner of things to think about, where your assets are, you know, the nature of marriage contracts being formed and so on, in order to structure things. You know, careful advice in the relevant jurisdictions is essential for that sort of thing. I mean, the other thing that I see a lot of is to avoid fractured succession, particularly of businesses that are not ready to be sold. So if you are able, if you're in a jurisdiction where you can transfer assets and have them held in perpetual ownership, or at least in an ownership that allows it to be survive your own death or incapacity, that is of great interest. And probably the most recent example, which is a very good example of how planning can really help a family. We had a client that contacted us in the autumn of 2016, and he wasn't very well. He had a very good think about what he wanted to do with his wealth, but he had cancer and was seeking treatment in the USA. And so we managed to get a structure in place in that instance, and it's not right for everyone, but for him, it was to have a private trust company with a discretionary trust. He had a blend of family and professionals that helped sit on the trustee board and transferred certain assets that he could transfer were transferred to this structure so that he hoped to get better. But if he didn't, that actually there was an ability then to benefit three classes of people that he wanted to care for: his immediate family, his siblings, and a charitable foundation he'd formed during his lifetime. And so this was done within about 10 weeks. And he was getting better, and he was proposed to return home, and actually he suddenly died. And the family office that I still speak to now, who help support the structure, support the family, and support some of the assets that they hold, which include things like private equity, which were not ready to be sold at the point of death, the family office speak about the fact they are still, I think they were 2 years after the principal's death, dealing with probate in his home jurisdiction. And they say that, goodness, we had a structure, because actually all of this wealth would have been tied up in this same administrative nightmare. So that for me is something, and still it goes on now. So his now teenage children are now in their 20s, and they are having their education about the assets, about the management, together with the professionals that are helping them look after it. And I think for me in my career, that's probably one of the perfect examples. It's extremely sad circumstances, but these things do happen. And I guess it's having the plan, isn't it? Or implementing the plan, or starting to have a plan, so you know what you want to happen when you're not there anymore.
And let's face it, one of the very few certainties in life is death. And we shrink from talking about it. How do you have a conversation, John, with your clients about such a sensitive matter?
Yeah, it is sensitive, and there is also a difference depending on culture, because some cultures lend themselves to those conversations far easier than others. I think actually the recent events of COVID have really driven home for many people their own mortality, and actually caused a real environment of reflection for everybody. And it's not about necessarily quantum of wealth either. Quantum is just relative to a specific set of circumstances and a specific family. So I think one shouldn't just look at dealing with these issues as the proprietary right of the very wealthy. It affects everybody. So I think it's a more broader discussion than most people think. I'm not surprised Bea was as busy as she was during COVID. Opening those discussions can be challenging. But again, it's a question of, I think, being honest with clients. It's a question of posing those questions. Actually, I think over time and with experience, you identify questions that you know the person in front of you wants you to ask them, but they don't want to necessarily volunteer it, if that makes sense.
You're talking about legacy as well, aren't you? Legacy
is a very broad topic to me, and I hit upon this idea fairly recently, and I always describe it as a bridge, a traditional sort of bridge structure with a pillar either side and a sort of riverbed or bedrock at the bottom. The bedrock is the sort of founder of the wealth and the family patriarch or matriarch, the leader of the family. That's the bedrock. The two pillars today are, and this is true, clients today have a very different view, and the younger generation, as Simon highlighted a few moments ago, do have a different view. It's not just about the financial piece. It's also about a societal piece, and societal in a very broad sense, not just philanthropy, but societal more generally. So the two pillars are your financial legacy on one end, your societal philanthropic legacy on the other, and the bridge in the middle is what you build so that you can achieve a safe transition from one generation to another. You cross over that generational bridge. Presenting it to a client in that way, you're not actually homing in on the fact they're going to die. You're just identifying a real problem that everybody faces, and actually reassuring them that they're not different. It's something that everybody faces. They find actually quite reassuring. Once you get it down to a very simple level of the key elements, without over elaborating what it may or may not be, they tend to open up to those discussions far more freely and almost with a sense of relief, actually. They want to talk about it, but frankly don't know how to quite often, because if they're doing it in their home in a family context, their concern is about the emotional reaction of those around the table. What they learn by talking to advisors, people as we have around this table, is that those emotional elements are gone. They don't need to fear them because they're in a completely emotionally neutral environment. So can speak freely, can express their concerns about the nephew, the son, the granddaughter, whoever it may be. And that is liberating, I think, for people. And in that way, they can develop their ideas around their plan far more freely.
I think I've worked out the secret of your success, John. You're the man with the plan. This is it for today's episode. Thanks very much to our fantastic guests, Bea Puotti and Siobhan Riley, and to you for listening. We will be back next time to explore the risk while managing your wealth.
You need the processes put in place before it happens. The more planning that can go into what happens when I can no longer look after myself, the more chance you've got of actually having a sensible solution.
We've moved into a world now where some people are choosing not to marry, having life partners who mean the same to them as a spouse, but older generations and maybe even, for example, the trust don't treat them in the same way.
Then suddenly this huge sum of money landed literally on their doorstep. And I had an interesting conversation with them and said, well, how did that make you feel? Just trying to understand from an emotional perspective, what was the impact? They summed it up in one word: petrified.
Make sure you follow The Wealth Chat wherever you're listening to this right now to be the first to know when that episode is available. Until next time, goodbye.